listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Patricia Mary, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the Saturday, Sunday, October 4th, 5th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And from the front page of Off Duty, a 1950s American ranch house makes a comeback. And this is by Antonio Van Deer. The American ranch house has, for decades, been dismissed as the real estate equivalent of the TV dinner, mass-produced, bland, and outmoded. Recently, though, home buyers are warming to the humble legacy of the post-World War II building boom, the single-story home marked by an offset front door, picture window, low pitch roof, and attached garage or carport. We're not talking only about the atomic ranch substyle, such as the coveted Eckler homes with their mid-century modern window walls and flat roofs. These days, home buyers are snapping up their less cool, traditional-looking cousins. Makeovers range from modern farmhouse tweaks of white siding and black window frames to overhauls like the minimalist recent model that has everything flat. 20 years ago, says Jennifer Knoll, an executive vice president of Compass Real Estate in Washington, D.C., people would say anything but a ranch or a split level, referring to the type that staggered three floors and connected them with short staircases. You almost couldn't give them away. Today, however, Realtor.com reports that ranch houses have appreciated 44.7% over the past 6 years, more than any other type of home. Remarkably, given their prevalence in the market, the same study found that ranch homes comprise more than a third of all for sale listings. New Corp, owner of the Wall Street Journal, also operates Realtor.com. Knoll's typical ranch house buyers are either young professionals, starting families, or retirees leaving oversized abodes. Downsizers love them, she says, noting that a single level accommodates aging in place. There used to be a big difference between the price of a two-story colonial and a one-story ranch or split level, observed Noel. I don't see that anymore. Some of these mid-century homes and even whole neighborhoods of them, such as Acres in Englewood, Colorado, have been placed on the National Registry of Historic Places or local historic registries. We hear, really? A ranch house? These are historic? Says Katie Hoke, architectural historian with Architectural Resource Group in Los Angeles. Yes, some are 70 years old and they convey significant design principles. Many of those principles, novel in the 1950s, appeal to home buyers today. The ranch ushered in the open concept plan, for example, jettisoning the formal living room. It was advertised as a family-centric home, says Laura, a historic preservation professional and principal of LK Preservation Specialist in Arlington, Virginia. Ideally, mom's in the kitchen, which she can see the kids watching Howdy Doody in the living room, and dad's in the yard grilling. Sub in Bluey for Mr. Doody in the post-war American dream looks a lot like today's casual lifestyles. Similarly, the connection to nature afforded by picture windows and sliding glass doors opening to the backyard drew ex-urbanites then as it does those cravings for the calm of greenery today. Current renovations, like that of architecture design Colleen Healy, seek an even greater link to the outdoors and sunshine. Her award-winning remodel of a 1956 ranch in Chevy Chase, Maryland, removed the split-levels cross-hip roof and added a band of windows that allow in sunlight but maintain privacy. The new flat roof rides a robust solar power system. Inside, painted drywall and a continuation of the exterior charcoal brick into the entrance continue the minimalistic transformation, as does replacing typical scroll-embellished stair railings with simple horizontal rail. In the mod, boxy results still a ranch? I don't know. It's its own animal, says Healy. Owner Sasha and her husband, Che, meanwhile, love the home's lights best. No matter where I am in the house, I have a view of trees and yard. It feels like you're outside, but you're not, said Sasha. When renovating a 1956 house in the Beverly Hills area, Samar took a more differential tack. To allow for another bedroom, bigger bathrooms, and walk-in closets, he dispatched Jack and Jill bathrooms and shaved square footage off oversized rooms. The trick is to keep it in line with modern living without taking away from the simplicity of a ranch, says the Los Angeles designer. To deal with the 8-foot ceilings throughout the house, a common feature among mid-century homes, reflecting the post-war standardization of building materials so that length, he raised only the ceiling in the century foyer to 11 feet. The architectural sleight of hand signals that the dwelling has high ceilings, and you don't change your mind as you walk through the house, he says. On the exterior, faded pink stucco gave way to char black wood. Extended roof beams created a trellis effect over the front door, whose walnut is weft with small portals. When they put the home on the market, 300 people showed up at the open house, called Samara. Within a day, the 2,700 square foot house on a quarter acre was in escrow, and it sold for over $4 million. In Costa Mesa, California, Craig O'Connell envisioned a clean, streamlined structure as he remodeled a family of five's Rambler, a contemporary nickname for the style. Cheap land allowed these single-story houses to ramble. The San Francisco architect stripped the exterior of the goofy-looking details, which had been added over the decades. These included a scallop fascia, storybook porch supports, and colonial-style shutters. He smoothed the facade with horizontal hardy siding in a deep green, energy-efficient windows, sand grids, and framed in low contrast black further simplified the exterior. An elevated modern profile is what I wanted to respect and bring forward in the remodel, he said. The happy homeowners, Travis and Aubrey, who shared the home with their three children, have one word of caution. Many homes, like theirs, are changing hands for the first time. Travis replaced the electrical panel and upgraded the sewer, water main, and HVAC system. There can be bigger fees than you're hoping for to bring it up to code and for safety, he said. Jessica, who often designs interiors for grand homes, chose a 2,500 square foot ranch in Wisconsin, when it came time to house her own family of four. She swapped the exterior peach vinyl for V-groove wood siding, then painted it in the areas of red brick the same color. Ranches frequently mix materials. These really calm the exterior down, she said. Inside, she forewent a gut job, envisioning instead with color, pattern, and texture. She ripped out a 60-year-old wall-to-wall carpeting and installed porcelain floors and brightly woven rugs to define areas in the open layout. Portuguese tiles personalized the kitchen. Small bathrooms ended up being a boom, she says, because they bring the kids out into communal areas. When you're headed to one room, you evidently bump into a person you want to see. From the fashion page, the Bad Weather Guide for Women. 10 clever pieces to keep you dry and warm, each under $250. And this is by Nora Kemlach. First one is, come slush season, it's crucial to have shoes in rotation that can withstand the elements without sacrificing style. These 100-proof, waterproof sneakers fend off soggy socks and feature hardy traction for slippery streets. The bonus, cherry pops of pastel, violet, and orange will be a welcome on particularly gloomy days. And this is a pair of, looks like, sneakers that have good heavy treads on the bottom. And it's Hunter Woman Sarah Casual Lace-Up Waterproof Sneakers. They do run $180. The second, stylists swear by Uniqlo Chic Meets Practical line of uber-warm hetch-tech tops. Now the brand has upped the luxury ante by adding cashmere to the fabric blend. Shown below is a periwinkle blue. This tissue-thin turtleneck is ideal for layering under V-neck knits and blazers. And it's just, the turtleneck is very large and looks like it could be very warm. And it's called C-Hetch-Tech Extra Warm Cashmere Blend Turtleneck, and it sells for $30. Keep your neck warm without the hassle of a scarf flip-flopping about. While many gaiters can skew sporty and basic, that's not the case with this navy and cream version, made from a blend of nylon, wool, and breathable cotton. The nautical stripes evoke summer days while adding a hint of French chic. Have fun pairing it with other pattern accessories or a tailored coat. And all it is a collar that you flip over your head and it keeps you warm. And it's called a gaiter, G-A-I-T-E-R, and it sells for $158. In the search of a one-and-done rainproof solution, cyclists and trekkers of every age rejoice. This water and wind resistant polyester jumpsuit is an effortless lightweight option that looks surprisingly stylish. Welded seams, a storm flap, and a hood shield outfits underneath. A draw cord at the waist allows you to cinch an ideal fit. And it's from top to bottom, long pants, long sleeves, and a hood. And it's called Rain's Jumpsuit Regular, and it does sell for $225. Protect even your most delicate shoes with these ingenious galoshes. Simply pop the waterproof rubber layer over any flat or boot to ward off snow, rain, or slush. Constructed with natural rubber, the slip-ons make a satirical statement in orange. They also come in olive green, navy, and black. Strut without fear of tumbling. Their sturdy grips are on the outer sole. And these are little boot shoes, but they just are shoe shape. and shoe size. They don't go up high, but they'll keep you dry and from slipping. They're called swim galosh, and they are $95. Who says down should be reserved for jackets? With a flattering wide leg cut and comfy mid-rise fit, these lightweight quilted pants wed the warmth of outerwear with the pleasure of wearing a statement trouser. Cinched drawstrings at the hem make it easy to adjust the silhouette, while an accompanying storage bag allows for handy winter packing. Throw them on solo or layer over leggings on an extra frigid morning. And these are quilted pants, and they are called Military Spirit Down Pants, and they sell for $169. They look very warm. From the outside, Noosh's clever fleece-lined tights convincingly mimic a sheer pair. Inside, a layer of snug fleece provides warmth and insulation. Bonus, the durable leggin-like material means this pair won't join the graveyard of ripped tights after a few wears, and they sell for $36. And it's Nosh Toast Sheer Illusion. Crafted from a sustainable bio leather made from corn, this lightweight matte crossbody is completely waterproof. There's a main compartment with a phone pocket, plus a handy slip pocket at the rear for easy access to your keys or wallet. The detachable strap offers a range of styling vibes from crossbody to clutch. Choose from black or steel blue, and the clutch costs $199. Sometimes wool socks and a hot light latte don't cut it. To keep your toes toasty, give boots a freezing forecast upgrade with UGG's fluffy insoles. Layers of sheepskin and cushioned foam deliver warmth and support. And these are insoles by UGG, and they cost $20. Dreading a winter of chronically icy fingers? Welcome the next level battery-powered cousin of frumpy hand warmer pouches. With three temperature settings, bowl cups, palm-sized rechargeable hand warmers reach a top temperature of 126 degrees and make an ideal companion for a range of winter excursions from skiing to evening commute. The magnetic duo can be connected for easy storage and stay warm for up to 8 hours. And these are just little pods that you warm up and put in your gloves, and they cost $16 at Amazon. And it's rechargeable magnetic hand warmers, and the company is OCOOPA. Enjoy shopping. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On the travel page, for an unconventional fall adventure, head to this quirky corner of Wisconsin. And this is by Jacqueline Cole. One brisk fall morning, the view from just outside Frank Lloyd Wright's bedroom is superb. The architectural design, Taliesin, his visionary home to frame the high hills of Wisconsin's Driftless Area, so named because ancient glacier drift never covered this land like it did elsewhere in the region. Across the 100 or so miles west of Madison, bluffs still soar. Valleys still plunge, and the air still holds more birdsong than bustle. Wright was drawn to the Driftless because of his ancestors, but also because of the wild beauty of this place, says Carrie Roadmaker, Taliesin's executive director. The architect used the land as a resource in multiple ways. Carrie tells me, from inspiration to construction, harnessing materials like sand, limestone, and oak. traveling to Tasman, a UNESCO World Heritage Site open to day trippers, as well as overnight visitors attending seasonal workshops, feels like visiting the middle of nowhere. But there's much more to this region than one architectural masterpiece. Wright's creative, rule-breaking spirit seeps deep into the area's soul and soil, attracting artists, chefs, cheesemakers, and more. In Wisconsin, one of the four states in the geological region, the Driftless has become a cultural term that means off-grid, avant-garde, and artisanal. Fall in this corner of Wisconsin is the ideal time to chase fine art and architecture. Finer cheese and the last of the region's farm fare before the cold sets in. Just don't expect more than the occasional bar or two of cell phone signal. Only 6 miles from Telson, another wonder peeks out of the hills, the House on the Rocks. If the former whispers architectural wisdom in your ear, the latter shouts, "Watch this!" The 1940s fever dream of eccentric architect Alex Jordan. The house is open to the public, though first-timers be warned. Walkways lead to a three-story whale made of concrete and an indoor carousel surrounded by hundreds of mannequin angels and animatronic puppets. It's like Telson on craziness. Both approach embody the Driftless psyche. 7 more miles down the road, also in the town of Spring Green, you'll find American Players Theater, one of the most renowned outdoor classical theaters in the nation. Few fall experiences around the country can beat a picnic and a Shakespeare play under the stars, but fear not if you find outdoor tickets sold out. The intimate indoor theater is lovely too. For a shoppable artistic fix, shop and stop at Wilson Creek Pottery, a Driftless mainstay. The tiny team has been handcrafting some of the state's most beautiful ceramic goods for the past 50 years. One of the region's most celebrated autumn events comes from Uplands Cheese, the makers of Pleasant Ridge Reserve, the most awarded cheese in American history. Uplands Optimal and only slightly less prestigious sibling, Rush Creek Reserve, is a decadent, soft cheese wrapped in spruce bark that drops only in October and November. Online orders typically sell out fast, but you can test your luck at various purveyors in the area, like the Spring Green General Store. The tightest hills mean that farms can't get very big, and so neither have most of the cheesemakers, says Andy Hatch, Uplands owner and cheesemaker. We've had to focus on being unique instead of big. Luckily, we have interesting trares to make that possible. The Driftless area accounts for the majority of small producer Wisconsin cheese. Beyond Uplands, don't miss Hook's Cheese Company and its 20-year-old cheddar, available for only the fourth time ever this fall and retailing at $209 a pound. The Driftless many organic farms feed the area's rapidly growing restaurant scene, with Driftless Cafe leading the charge in the Vernon County, just east of the Mississippi River. The county has the second highest concentration of organic farms of any U.S. county, says Zook, the James Beard nominated chef and the cafe's co-owner. The region embraces intentional inefficiency, he explains, opting for smaller yields and working by hand. I've always felt a little bit punk rock and knowing where your food is coming from. That's an act of rebellion. For rebellious acts of the hoppy variety, head to New Garls Brewing Company, famous for the cult favorite Spotted Cow. For years, owners Deb and Dan Carey were told their only in Wisconsin production model would never work at scale. Today, the employee-owned craft brewery nears the nation's top 10 by sales volume. For a quintessential way to wrap up a driftless trip, grab a Spotted Cow and explore the grounds. Built to resemble cathedral ruins, your eye, though, will soon be drawn away from the structures and to the hills rolling in every direction. Frank Lloyd Wright would surely approve. The Lowdown, a brief guide to the driftless. Getting there. Amtrak's new Borealis route runs daily between Chicago and Minneapolis, stopping in La Crosse, Wisconsin, an easy gateway to the region. Otherwise, fly into Madison's Dane County Regional Airport, which symbols MSN, or drive around 3 hours from Chicago to Minneapolis. Eating there at Driftless Cafe, daily menus showcase whatever local farmers bring in. Next door, Noble Rhine plates up the most stunning cheese boards. Reunion in Spring Green offers elevated, locally driven barbecue, and in the town of Paoli, 7 Acres Dairy Company Autumn Diner Series showcase driftless fare reimagined by chefs from across the nation. Staying there, if you want to base yourself out of the region's hub, La Crosse, a good option is the Charmant Hotel, a former candy factory, which combines comfy digs with sensational cocktails on the Mississippi River. Farther from civilization, Onaway Place features modern, woodsy cabins straight out of Martha Stewart's dreams. The most committed cheese lovers can opt for the state's most recognizable Airbnb, a bright yellow A-frame cabin that resembles a wedge of Swiss cheese. Enjoy your time in Wisconsin. From off-brand, Armani's Farewell had it all. From Richard Gere to chic agings. Story Citron. As dusk fell in Milan Sunday night, three vivacious former fashion editors discussed their late friend, designer Giorgio Armani. He was the one who invented the jacket for women, to give them the strength that only men used to have, says Carla Vanni, 89, Cucci Gabarelli, 95. Jumped in. Those jackets were so recognizable, so iconic. Christina Brigidi, 93, added, and he invented putting fashion in film. The women were gathered among with 700 or so other guests, including stars, including Cate Blanchett and Lauren Hutton and Spike Lee, to take in the latest collection Armani designed, as well as canonizing exhibits of his influential 50 years in fashion. The spring fashion show commemorating the brand's anniversary was set to be a special one even before the designer's death this summer. The 91-year-old Titan designed the 127 looks and put the finishing touches on the exhibition before the August holidays. While he hoped to go to one of his Italian houses by the sea, he ended up staying in Milan, where he died at home. After an emotional memorial service earlier this month, the fashion show served as another public send-off to a prolific designer. I knew him as someone who helped me create characters, said a tuxedoed Richard Gere after the show. The first two met when Armani designed the costumes for the 1980 movie American Gigolo, which catapulted them both to worldwide fame. You saw that tonight, too. These are all characters from his imagination. Many of Armani's favorite models from the different eras of his company walked in the show, while a pianist played at a grand piano in the courtyard of the museum. The music, including Binoche and the scattered lanterns, echoed his memorial service earlier this month. Inspired by the deep blue sparkling water and green hills of his favorite home on the Milan Island, the looks were easy and fluid, an Armani trademark. Navy blue suits for men and women were cut generously. Gray houndstooth jackets were paired with cornflower blue pants. Beaded midnight blue evening gowns shimmered. Amid rampant speculation as to the future of the company, Armani's niece and head of women's wear, Silvania Armani, and his companion and head of men's wear, Leo Dorocco, took the final bow to a standing ovation. Along with Armani's niece, Roberta Armani, his nephew, Andre, and his sister, Rosanna, they will be among the stakeholders that contend with the will that stipulates that 15% of the company be sold within 18 months. The staunchly independent company, which has long fended off acquisition attempts from the likes of Bernard Arault at LVMH, is a strong position 50 years after its founding. The Arcachel exhibit at the Pinochco, which will run through January 2026, underlines Armani's stylish signature, from soft suiting to velvet mandarin collar jackets to beaded evening wear. Just juxtaposition against the brightly painted, extravagant Italian paintings from the 15th and 16th centuries on the wall. The architectural looks show how Armani broke with the Italian aesthetics tradition of gold, primary colors, and pompous religiosity. While his contemporaries Versace and Dolce and Gabbana leaned into that decadence, Armani had a low-key approach to luxury. His style, with its hush carpets, flat shoes, and dull colors, whispered instead of shouted. Quiet luxury before the term was overused on TikTok. That unassuming quality was something that extended to his employees, too. When I spoke with Armani for one of his last interviews in 2024, he said he wanted to impart humbleness and modesty on his staff. It's a lesson that Vincenzo, a vice president and top salesman at New York's Madison Avenue store, learned over his 30 years working at the company. He was one of the many longtime employees who came to Milan twice in September to pay their respects to their boss, both for his memorial service and his last show. He reverently showed me his phone screen, a photo of himself and Armani. Vincenzo told me that his clients, which have included many of the world's most powerful players and celebrities, became more confident when wearing Armani. They confirmed to me that it changed their life entirely in the business world and for special events. From orchestrating his own posthumous anniversary show to outlining a detailed plan for his foundation and heirs, Armani set up his final act impeccably. As the rare creative director who was also the chief executive director of his company, he was a bit of a controlled freak. "When I have an idea, I want to see it through to the end," he told me last year. But not even the man often called the King of Milan can dictate what happens to his affairs after his death. It remains to be seen what will happen to the global multi-billion-dollar company Armani built from scratch. You're listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On Wine by Letty Teague, Beat the Crowds in Burgundy, A Winemaker's Guide to the Places Locals Love. There's a town in Burgundy every wine lover must visit at least once. And judging by the crowds of tourists I encountered there last month, quite a few Americans have taken up this to heart. Located in France's fabled Côte d'Or region, Beaune, B-E-A-U-N-E, is Burgundy's most important wine town. For celebrated winemakers Veronica, Beaune is something else. It's her hometown. Although I visited before, when I returned a few weeks ago, I wanted to experience the place as a native might. So I reached out to Veronica. The itinerary she shared offers a take on a place no package tour could. Even for a repeat visitor like me, it held plenty of surprises. And though Veronica simply acknowledged her own winery, I'll do more than that. No trip to Beaune would be complete without a visit to the historic cellars of Maison Joseph Bourdon. Where to taste wine now? This domain is an easy 15-minute walk from the town center. Owner Maron left his family's wine business in nearby Beaune and purchased the 200-year-old Domaine Sequin Miguel in 2004. Today, Maron produces a wide range of wines, from basic Bourgogne to Grand Cru. The savory 2021 Sequin Miguel Beaune Champions we tasted was particularly noble. All tastings, $59 by appointment, were conducted by Marin, whose Veronica described as fun and talented, which he most certainly is. In the nearby village of Savigny-Beaune, Veronica's sister-in-law, Claude, and Claude's brother, Francois, run this domain, which has been in the family since 1834. Its house and formal garden may appear rather grand, but I found Claude unpretentious and warm. After a stint in Paris, she took over the winemaking from her mother. Her wines are elegant and expressive. All tasting fees vary by appointment, including Premier Cru and Grand Cru wines, are conducted by Claude or Francois. This casual restaurant is barely 2 years old, but I hope it will be around for years to come. One of the three owners, Patin, described a menu as similar to Spanish tapas, but with French food. The engaging Moran runs the front of the house. He actually nudged me toward the wine, the 2023 Domaine Jaron, which sells for $75 a bottle. That costs less than half as much as the one I initially chose. The food was terrific, too. I definitely understood why Veronica has a soft spot for this place. Le Table du Square, the convenial Table du Square, is one of Veronica's firm favorites. Proprietor Romain confirmed a recent uptick in American diners, opening the doors of our city, eager to discover a certain art of wine in Burgundy. The substantial list changes almost daily. Sommelier Broquet helped me fit my choice of main course around my chosen wine. The thrilling mineral 2022 Herbert LeMay, which sells for $158, Veronica counseled pairing it with the pork medallions, and she was so right. La Bistro, this simple, stylish spot is so unassuming. I walked by it twice before realizing I overshot the address. The small lunch, which sells for $53, is a menu of delicious bistro fare, including a terrific tomato tart starter, and for dessert, a scrumptious Paris-based pastry. The wine list range from Grand Crus to top producers. Basic Bourgogne at prices close to or below U.S. retail. My favorite, the 2021 Bourjot Chardonnay, which sold for $59. To learn more, the hotel, the 15th century hospital operated as such until 1971. Doreen was born here. Veronica was born there and now operates as a history museum, emphasizing the link between wine and health throughout. The hospice has vineyard holdings all over Burgundy, and a wine auction held there each November raises funds for a variety of charitable causes, including the town's modern hospital. The Bourjot, launched in 2023 in a contemporary structure on the outskirts of Bourane, this museum offers an engaging guide to the wines and vineyards of Burgundy, as well as a tasting bar and restaurant. Without paying admission, you can stroll the walkway around the property for a striking view of the countryside. But this wine geek was particularly excited by the enormous interactive map inside. Touch the hundreds of vineyards depicted for more information on each one. Sorry for mispronouncing some of the French words. Slow Food Fast by Kitty Greenwald. Not the same old chicken dinner, a speedy kebab to make tonight. And this is by Chef Michael Refty. And his restaurants are Albi, Yellow, two locations, and all in Washington, D.C. He's known for bringing the flavors of his Palestinian heritage to the D.C. dining scene, playing with smoke, spices, and charcoal to create dishes that marry mid-Atlantic bounty with a Middle Eastern palate. When Michael Refty was growing up, his grandfather owned restaurants across Washington, D.C. Though the menus did not reflect the Palestinian fare his family relished at home. After committing himself to professional kitchens, Refty returned to D.C. with a plan to reconnect to his roots. His first restaurant, Albi, which is my heart in Arabic, opened in 2020. Since then, he's added Yellow, a cafe with two locations, and a chic Middle Eastern bistro to his stable. In his first Slow Food Fast contribution, Refty shares a classic grilled chicken kebab served with pitas and sumac inflected onions, a marinade of yogurt, unripened mango, ginger, garlic, and turmeric lends sweet, sharp depth. If time allows, an overnight rest yields the fullest flavor, but a brief marinade will also do the trick. Charcoal is Refty's favorite grilling medium, but a gas grill or pan does wonders. The key, he cautions, is to cook the chicken until it releases from the grates with little resistance. Char is good, but you don't want it blackened, he said. It's best to take your time. Chicken kebabs with onion, mint salad, yogurt, and a warm pita. Enriched by a spiced yogurt mango marinade, these tender chicken kebabs are speedy but full of layered flavor. It takes 35 minutes and it serves 4 people. The ingredients are 1.5 unripened green mangoes peeled and pitted, 3 tablespoons of chopped red onions plus 1/2 a large of red onion thinly sliced, 1.5 garlic cloves grated, 1.5 inch piece of fresh ginger peeled and grated, kosher salt, 1.5 teaspoons of turmeric, 3/4 of a teaspoon of ground fenugreek. It's spelled fenugreek. That is also optional. 3 teaspoons of honey, 2.5 teaspoons of sumac, 2 limes juiced, 5.5 tablespoons of olive oil, 2.5 cups of Greek yogurt, 2 pounds of boneless, skinless chicken thighs cubed. 1 handful of fresh mint leaves, roughly chopped. Lemon wedges for serving. 4 pitas warmed for serving. Here are the directions. Prepare the grill or heat a grill pan to medium high. Add mango to food processor with 3 tablespoons of chopped onion, 1 grated clove of garlic, ginger, 1.5 teaspoons of salt, turmeric, honey, 1.5 teaspoons of sumac, juice of 1.5 limes, and 1.5 tablespoons of olive oil. Blend until completely smooth. Add 1.5 cups of yogurt to a large bowl. Stir in mango mixture and chicken. Cover and marinate at least 15 minutes. Meanwhile, in a medium bowl, soak sliced onions in ice water at least 5 minutes. Drain and dry thoroughly. Then toss onions with 1/4 cup of oil, 1 teaspoon of sumac, pinch of salt, and lime juice. Rest at least 15 minutes. Thread chicken onto 4 skewers, making sure pieces aren't too tightly packed. Grill until meat cooks through and caramelizes on all sides, about 15 minutes total. In a small bowl, combine remaining grated garlic and yogurt. Season with salt. Toss mint into onion mixture. Serve kebabs with onion salad, seasoned yogurt, lemon wedges, and warm pitas. From the food and drink page, a leaf blower for your kitchen? Absolutely. Heads up, crumbs and water droplets. The hedgehog of jet delivers real power in its stream of focused air. Cleanup has never been easier or this much fun. And this is by Sal Vedgela. I had a blast messing around with this roughly 9-inch tall hedgehog jet blower as it shoved a glass jar of pasta sauce aside, set tuna tins skittering across the counter, and even got a 5-pound dumbbell to roll over. I wondered, could this tool, the size of a hammer, but with the power of a leaf blower, actually be useful around the kitchen? Weighing under 2 pounds, the hedgehog holds a USB-C rechargeable battery in its sleek metal body. A jet-like turbine sucks air in and forces it out the narrow business end in a tidy beam. Designed in Norway, this feels like the kind of power tool Apple or Dyson might create. Observing it in action, I was, you could say, blown away. It sells for $300. How it works. The hedgehog has 4 speeds controlled by a single button. Set it to low, it outperforms any hair dryer. At full blast, it hits 162 miles per hour. For comparison, my go-to battery-powered leaf blower uses a brick-size 40-volt pack to reach 180 miles per hour. With a 1.25-inch opening, the hedgehog delivers a tighter airstream than my leaf blowers. Better for detailed tasks. It runs 15 to 30 minutes on a full battery, depending on the speed, and recharges in 45 minutes to about 3 hours, depending on your charger. The tool goes for days on a single charge because it makes quick work of the task it tackles. The result, the hedgehog is a drying and cleaning beast. It blows water off slow-to-dry surfaces, plastic cups, reusable bags, exhaust fan grease traps in such a satisfying manner you might wash them twice for the kicks. Hand wash a chef knife or a nonstick pan, and you can dry it for storage without grabbing a towel. The hedgehog clears crumbs from the recess of toaster ovens, the back of a pantry, or that limbo under the refrigerator. Wash grills and smokers, then blast them to a spot-free finish like a car detailer. It comes with a bit of a learning curve. A single control button can slip past off if you're not careful, which can result in a bit of a mess. The flash base lets it stand upright, but the all-metal body isn't something you want crashing to the counter, so it's safer to set it on its side. There are minor caveats given the power that this thing packs. Other article from the food and drink page, how to make Swiss chard sexy? The secret may surprise you. Believe it or not, you have to boil it. That's the key to a surprisingly silky texture and the first step in this delicious Swiss chard frittata recipe. And this is by Ian Connor. I met my friend Alan almost 20 years ago when we were both working at Gourmet Magazine. He is whimsical, funny, snarky, slightly obnoxious, and at his core, I think, very sincere. Once he told me that the most useful thing he learned from me about cooking is to separate the ribs and stems of Swiss chard. Of all the things I've talked and written about over my decades of cooking in test kitchens and restaurant kitchens, that was Alan's takeaway? It's true that the stems and leaves cook at significantly different rates. You were to cook Swiss chard fully intact, without separating the stems and the leaf would disintegrate by the time the stems were tender. Alan's takeaway is on spot. I'm just surprised that it's the one thing he took away. Among the other things that are worth knowing about Swiss chard, you should boil it. I know, boiling vegetables sounds so old-fashioned and boring and bad. It calls to mind institutional meals of the worst kind. But if there's one thing you take away from this article and the accompanying recipe, let it be the habit of boiling your Swiss chard. It's fast. Water transfers heat much more efficiently than air does. Roasting is an example of cooking with air. It's a great way to permeate food with salt. Salt the water and the water salts the vegetable. It develops and deepens the flavor. In boiling water, the vegetable starches begin to convert to sugars, bringing out a natural sweetness. It enhances the texture in just the right way. Unlike roasting, which removes water and creates a nice crunch in some vegetables, boiling brings softness and, to Swiss chard in particular, a wonderful silky texture. It removes some of the properties people don't enjoy. These include oxalates, natural occurring compounds in Swiss chards that can burn the back of your throat, particularly when eating the vegetable raw. Boil Swiss chard, simply seasoned with salt and pepper. It's a staple side dish in my kitchen in autumn. It's steeped in a supporting player in main roll recipes too, featuring duck, chicken, pork, or venison. In this frittata, it's a star of the plate. Prior to baking, I blend the Swiss chard leaves with the egg base. Before adding the stems to the base, I boil them until tender and they maintain their texture as the eggs they capture in cooking and coalesce. The finished frittata delivers silky Swiss chard and custardy eggs with a pretty green color that my whimsical friend and my 4-year-old daughter both can appreciate, especially with a side of ham. Swiss chard frittata. When boiled until silky and tender, Swiss chard can stand alone as a side, but combining that boiled chard with traditional custard ingredients elevates it to a wonder of an entree. Serve this beautiful green frittata warm or at room temperature with a simple salad or a salty side of ham. It takes 1 hour and it serves 6 to 8 people. You need 1.5 pounds of Swiss chard, stems and leaves separated, 4 eggs, 1 cup of buttermilk, 1 cup of heavy cream, and 1.5 teaspoons of salt. Directions. Bring a medium pot of water to boil, then season generously with salt. Cut Swiss chard stems crosswise into 1-inch pieces. Boil the stems until tender, 10 to 12 minutes. Use a slotted spoon to remove stems and transfer to a 10-inch oven-proof cast iron or non-stick skillet or a buttered pie plate. Boil chard leaves in the same water until very tender, about 8 minutes. Drain leaves and let cool to warm. Transfer warm, drained leaves to a blender or food processor and puree with eggs, buttermilk, cream, and salt. Pour egg mixture over charred stems, stirring to distribute stems evenly. Transfer skillet to oven and bake until custard is set, 30 to 40 minutes. Let cool to warm, then slice and serve. Enjoy your frittata. You have been listening to the reading of articles and features from Saturday, Sunday, October 4th, 5th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia Mary. Thank you for listening. God bless and be safe out there.
Coming up next to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Harper's Magazine at 8 o'clock. We have Sports Illustrated at 9 o'clock. We have The Athletic, a section of the New York Times. Stay with us for these readings and more through the rest of the evening. Are you facing challenges with vision loss and need help with your smartphone, sending emails, navigating the internet, and staying connected with your family via Visually Impaired Advancement? Is offering free classes for seniors weekly at multiple locations with free assistance for your smartphone, email, and internet skills. There's a new session every week, and it rotates between the South Towns and the North Towns. It's at your local Erie County Libraries, and at 10 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. For more information, call Elhana Porter at 716-888-4632. Again, that's 716-888-4632. Thank you. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low